Okay, we are live from the Bergino Baseball Clubhouse at 67 East 11th Street in the landmark cast iron building in Greenwich Village, New York City. Tonight, we are honored to have Kostya Kennedy, the author of 56, Joe DiMaggio, and The Last Magic Number in Sports. It is our first book event of our fall series, and as we always do, to those of you who have never been here before in person or are listening to this podcast, welcome. To those of you who have been here before, welcome home. I don't know how many of you have been fortunate enough yet to read Kostya's book, but, and I do not say this lightly, this is a great book. Kostya is a great writer and a great storyteller. And just in brief, just to give you a little sense of who's sitting here with us tonight, Kostya is a senior editor at Sports Illustrated, and he writes on a wide range of subjects. Before joining Sports Illustrated, he was a staff writer at Newsday and contributed to the New York Times and the New Yorker. He earned an MS from Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism, from which he received a Pulitzer Fellowship. He has taught in the graduate journalism programs at Columbia and NYU, and tonight he's in the clubhouse, and we're honored to have him here.
Good to be here.
Thank you. So I think a nice place to start would be, I'm not going to ask how old you are. You're younger than I am, though, and DiMaggio was ahead of my time, so he was certainly way ahead of your time. And this book, for those who don't know, this is not a Joe DiMaggio book about his entire life. It's not Marilyn Monroe and Mr. Coffee and TV things. It's about the summer of 1941, his 56-game hitting streak. And it's about DiMaggio, and it's about what happened in the summer of 1941 in America and in the world. So I'm interested, what brings a young guy to want to write a book about this guy and this specific time?
Yeah, well, I think the idea started, you know, I've been at Sports Illustrated for a while, and as my colleagues at SI can say, a lot of times you get asked, well, like, what's the greatest event you ever covered, or, you know, what's your most memorable story? They usually think you're going to say a Super Bowl or a World Series or a Stanley Cup Final, or really they think you're going to say a swimsuit. But for me, the most dramatic and exciting event I was at was watching Cal Ripken play 4.5 innings for the Baltimore Orioles in 1995. And I was there the night that he tied Lou Gehrig's record of consecutive games played, 2,130. And it was surprisingly powerful. I mean, you knew it was going to happen. There was no real drama to it, right? It was just... But the moment happened, they start showing Gary on the screen, and everybody got goosebumps and can really feel it. And so that kind of stayed with me over the years. I was just kind of starting out at SI, and I really made a big impression. And the steroid era kind of comes and goes, and the home run records certainly are polluted. A lot of our records have been changed, you know, because of it, and in a tainted way. I'm like, not that if Roy Hobbs comes up and hits 75 home runs, that's great, but just guy after guy hitting more than 60 home runs. So I started thinking, you know, what's left? What is left as a number the way Lou Gehrig's number was, 2130, that has survived this and still is iconic and has resonance? And what to me was left was 56. And it was, it's really something that still has power even now. So I started just sort of looking into it and getting interested. I was going to read a picture as a story or something like that. And the more I started looking into it and just realizing, as Jay was saying, the time that we were in, and people used to call 1941 that summer the last free summer, the last innocent summer, even while they were living it, because we knew we were about to get into the war. Hundreds of thousands, millions of young men were drafted. FDR is coming out on the radio and talking about, you know, the Nazi power and Hitler's surge and all of that. That's a scary time. And it was in this time that DiMaggio had this incredible streak. And so they started getting into it and seeing the environment around it and between both the environment and the country, and also DiMaggio himself. We think of DiMaggio, everybody has some kind of thought of him, and it's always intertwined with him in his sort of silver hair elegance later, or Monroe, or Mr. Coffee. But this was really the moment, he was a baseball star when it began, but this was the moment that kind of turned him from being just a baseball star to being an American icon. That was, of course, further later in life when he met Marilyn and all that, but this is really the event that transformed him. So, it's kind of a long answer, but it just started to get, the story started to unfold and get richer and richer, and I thought there's really something here, and there's a lot that hadn't been told about it, and I felt I could do something with it, and that was it.
Well, you did a masterful job with it, and as you got into it, did a lot surprise you that you started to uncover about DiMaggio in particular?
Yeah, I mean, I think that a couple of things surprised me. I guess in terms of Joe, it's probably no secret, I guess, but to me it was striking. He wasn't educated in any way. He not only didn't graduate high school, he didn't really go to high school. And his parents were illiterate, both in Italian, which is basically what they spoke, and in English. And he knew on his younger brother, Dom, who was then called a little professor and all that, he was a really bright guy, graduated high school and went on to be successful in business afterwards. But Joe, he felt, when he came to New York, he was kind of overmatched. He was supposed to be Joe DiMaggio, kind of holding court and doing everything, you know, presiding over people that took short bars and stuff like that. And he felt overwhelmed, and he felt very afraid of being seen as rude, being seen as uneducated. And I think a lot of his aloofness, a lot of people felt that Joe wasn't the greatest guy, especially later in life. He was very distant, very cold. And I think a lot of it came from an insecurity, because things were going on and he didn't get it. You know, and he'd have to have Lefty Gomez, who was his best friend in 1941, and he would sort of decipher things for Joe. And so that, to me, was the most interesting thing, I think. It's sort of this core realization of what this young man, he's 26 years old this summer, he's about 20 when he comes to New York, and what he was confronted with.
And one of the things that you talk about, which I found extremely interesting, was that on one hand, he liked the attention, and on the other hand, he loathed the attention.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I mean, he liked being on a pedestal. I mean, he liked people to know who he was. You know, later in life, after he got to be called a voted greatest living ball player, he insisted on being referred to that every time. He was Joe DiMaggio, greatest living ball player. But he was also very uncomfortable with it. And in the book, he's married to a movie star, not that movie star, but to Dorothy Arnold. And when they're out together, she's really, even though she's a little younger than him, Minnesota, she's pretty smart and has these friends in show business, and she's kind of the one who's holding court and guiding the conversation. Joe just wasn't comfortable in those kind of situations. He would shut down, he would lash out. So it was that kind of dichotomy. He liked to have the eyes on him, he liked to have the attention, but he didn't like a lot of the other stuff that goes with it. And that was something that would manifest even more so later in his marriage
model. Right. Well, you mentioned Dorothy Arnold.
Right.
You mentioned a few names. One of the things that you do beautifully is that you reveal DiMaggio through these relationships that he has. So, if we could, I'm just going to mention a few of the names, some you've already mentioned, but just talk a little bit about that as you do in the book.
Sure.
So, Dorothy Arnold, as you mentioned, she was a movie star. When he married her, she was already a movie star. Is that correct?
Yeah.
So, but it was not exactly a marriage in paradise, so to speak.
No, it wasn't. I mean, he was in some ways he's very simple, but he was also a sort of complex and contradictory guy. And one of the things about Dorothy, and I was able to speak to a lot of people who knew her, and she had a sister who revealed a lot of stuff about her, so she kind of emerged as a character who sometimes you'd be reporting it to guide you with what you have, so I was able to find a lot of stuff on her. But their relationship, more than one person would talk to you about how he would miss her a lot when he was on the road. Later when he was in the army and he pined for her, trying to figure out a way to call her, wasn't that easy then. But when he was home, he could be very indifferent to her, kind of take her for granted. And the biggest thing, Joe's biggest weapon was silence. He could just not say anything. I mean, it was kind of hard to do, you know, but he could just go jade without saying a thing to his wife. And he could be that way. She, you know, she would, by becoming this Joe DiMaggio, she achieved the celebrity that she probably would not have achieved. She was in the movie, and if you were in 1941, if you knew who she was, in all likelihood, she would have been like a couple big movies with Bela Lugosi, and she was making a name for herself, but she wasn't Marlene Dietrich or anything like that. So at once by marrying Joe, she became a sort of larger figure, but she also gave up her career. Joe was not going to let her work. And that was very difficult for her. So she had a lot of resentment for Joe, too, especially during what this is a lot of things that happened in the streets became a microcosm for their relationship. So in the streets, as Joe is ascending, she's home and she's pregnant with what will be Joe's only child, and kind of like answering his fan mail and opening up letters, and everybody's just calling her at this point, Mrs. Joe. She even lost her surname completely. And she's not happy about it, you know? And so it was a very difficult relationship, although I do think that they loved each other very much and had some great times together and went out with people in the city, and she gave him a world that he might not have had, and he, of course, gave her an eminence that she would not have had.
And another person who you have mentioned briefly, his brother Dominic,
yeah.
Who played for, he played for the Boston Red Sox that yeah. particular season. If you could talk a little bit about...
Well, I will say, first of all, I got to speak to Dominic a few times for the book, and he was really gracious to me. He since passed away, and he was not doing so well at that time. But he was very... He was really sharp, and he was really giving of his time. He'd get a little cranky at certain points, but he was really giving of his time. Just as an aside, there were six people, maybe more, who I spoke to enough length in the acknowledgments to acknowledge them who since passed away. So it tells you where we were in time. It tells you if I call you, I don't want to say.
Thanks for telling me now.
So Dom really gave me a lot, maybe even partly knowing where he was at. He was a little bit, he didn't tell me like any scandalizing stuff, but he went into stuff that's been pushing that maybe he might not have gotten into if Joe was alive or if he was really not. There was a lot of jealousy, I think, in the relationship. Dom was always Joe's little brother, even though he became quite a good ball player. He was a head smaller and much thinner. And a lot of, when he first came up, oh, you're only in the majors with Joe got you here. He could never beat Joe DiMaggio. Conversely, Dom was a baby of eight kids, and the mom doted on him, and the sisters doted on him. He was smart, as I said. And Joe was very jealous of that affection. He was a little angel. And so it was a difficult time, and he came and stayed with Joe in his apartment, on the Upper West Side in 41, because that was basically the only season that Joe lived there. And Dom did that, but then when he saw him later during the streak, they didn't really talk at all. He said they didn't talk. And Bobby Doran, who the Red Sox second baseman then, said it was just amazing, like he wouldn't even know they were brothers. They would not go. They'd come together for the camera. I mean, they weren't like, they didn't act like they didn't like each other in public, but they could really go a long time being very distant from one another. So I think that was kind of the hallmark of that relationship, and indicative in some ways of Joe's relationship with other people, too.
Which leads us into a relationship with his closest friend on the Yankees, the great pitcher Lefty Gomez.
Right. And Lefty was absolutely a cut-up, you know, he was always bantering with people, and great for the writers. The writers all loved him, his teammates all loved him, he was always joking, always had something smart to say. And he kind of took Joe under his wing. It was a really smart move by Joe McCarthy, the manager, who groomed them together. Gomez was an established star when DiMaggio came, and shortly after he put them together. And they really hit it off because they were foils. They were foils to one another. And Joe DiMaggio would say that he'd look over at the bar, he'd be sitting at the end, not buying anybody a drink. And Lefty Gomez would be carrying on. And he'd say, boy, I wish I could be like that. I wish I could do it. But he couldn't. Joe couldn't ever let himself lose the ball the way that Gomez could. During the hitting streak, he would kind of, Gomez began fielding they were roommates on the road, and Gomez would not only keep people away from the door and answer and start joke, oh yeah, you're here to see me, and start signing autographs and stuff. Joe's not here, even though Joe was in the back. But also, for the media and stuff, he would kind of sidle up next to Joe if he was doing an interview and interject, and Joe would kind of look over and see what it might be saying he should answer. And you can see it sometimes when DiMaggio does answer for himself and Lefty's not around. It's amazing how awkward what comes out of his mouth is, and contradictory, and he just can't quite do it. Lefty is right there with a little quip or something. Lefty and his wife June was also in the movie, and she and Dorothy became good friends. And they had a really tight relationship. They used to go up to Bear Mountain together and like spend the day camping or whatever. They'd go out together at night in the city. So he was probably his best friend, certainly in 1941, and he was rarely as close to anybody in his life, I think, as he was Lefty Gomez. Because there was no real competition. Lefty was so much older, he was a pitcher.
Right.
It was different. And during the streak, the table had really turned. Now, Joe was the star, and Lefty was barely able to get a contract for that season. He was nearing the end of his career. Had this kind of resurgence and pitched better than they had in years that year. So they were really good for each other.
It's a fascinating relationship, the two of them. And a man that you had mentioned, the guy who put them together as roommates, the manager, Joe McCarthy.
Yeah. Joe McCarthy's been a really interesting guy, way ahead of his time in terms of the stuff he takes for granted now. I mean, in terms of how to just even player positioning and when to hit runs, stuff that just, he's really, now you learn basically in Little League, but then just wasn't used all the time by Major League Management. He's kind of go up and hit the ball. But McCarthy was much more on point with everything. He would sort of bring pitchers to sit next to him during the game, and they could watch and analyze the game, every batter. But his relationship with Joe, one thing Joe really liked was money, DiMaggio. And he would hold out every year. And in 38, he had a particularly long holdout. And management was saying, look, we're just going to have to get on without him. And McCarthy at one point piped up and said, oh, yeah, the Yankees would be all right. Joe should take his contract. You know, if we don't have him, we're going to be okay. To that effect. And DiMaggio, who eventually had to take, didn't have much leverage in the final analysis, never really forgave McCarthy for that. When the streak came around, it was kind of a thing that started to change because McCarthy started doing things that he never had done, such as letting him swing at 3-0 with, you know, one of the, when you need to like get the winning run on base kind of thing, you know, the time when you wouldn't do that, but to try to keep the streak alive. There's a famous time when Tommy Hendricks was up with one out of run on first base, and McCarthy let him sacrifice bunt, to stay out of a double play. Because if he had hit into a double play, Joe DiMaggio wouldn't have gotten up, and his streak might have ended. So there were little concessions along the way that DiMaggio was aware that McCarthy was doing to accommodate. And this was a key part of sort of their relationship coming together, and by the time he gets to breaking the record at the time in the 40s, they're shaking hands together, and they're, you know, really together on the, you know, for the front of media and in actuality, they sort of made the team their own together. So it was a repairing of their relationship.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And one more guy that I wanted to get your thoughts about as far as a relationship. On the wall here we have by James Fiorentino, a beautiful original watercolor of DiMaggio, and right next to him is Lou Gehrig.
Yeah. Well, that was a really, one thing that happened during the streak was that Gehrig died. That 19 game in the streak. he hadn't been on the team now for a couple of years. He was 41, and Derek played his last game in 39. But there was always this sense that people couldn't really believe that Lou Gehrig was a good guy. Even though he clearly was, he seemed completely, you know, invincible. Lou Gehrig played all those games in a row and everything. When he died, Joe was about 19, 20 games in the street. And it became really DiMaggio's team. Like, that was it. The specter of Gehrig wasn't there anymore. The big funeral that a lot of people came after. And it affected Joe quite a bit. He appreciated, Gehrig was also very silent with the media. He didn't talk to him. When Joe first came into the majors, he was worried about how Gehrig was receiving, and Gehrig saw him in the clubhouse and comes up and shakes hands and says, "Good to have you with us, Joe." And Joe said, "Thanks." And the two of them, that's a long conversation. But the other thing that Gehrig handled really well is that it was always Babe Ruth's team, and then it was Lou Gehrig. And then for a couple of years, it was just Gehrig, but they weren't winning the World Series. And then DiMaggio comes, and he's all wrapped in intrigue and coming from the West Coast. And now it's Joe DiMaggio and Lou Gehrig. And Gehrig would always play kind of second banana. And we're talking about a guy who not only had been the best player on any team in the league then, but had been the best player on 95% of all teams ever, or 98%, you know. And he handled it really, really well. And Joe was impressed by that and respected it quite a bit. So they had that relationship, and Joe and Gehrig would kind of joke around a little bit in the years that they overlapped, and it made an impact on him. The team was in Detroit, but Dorothy went to the funeral and saw Eleanor Gehrig and his wife, and so it was a powerful thing to Joe that summer, and as with the relationship throughout his life.
Yeah, they're all fascinating relationships, and you, I love the way that you do it in the book. You really, you understand DiMaggio through these relationships, the way you describe them. And so let's get to the streak a little bit. Just to put this into perspective, DiMaggio hitting 56 straight games. The closest anyone has, this was 70 years ago. As you mentioned, with the steroid era, all the tainted records, home run records, all these other batting records have become a joke with cartoon characters breaking them and everything. This record, nobody's gotten close, basically. I mean, in 70 years, Pete Rose hitting 44 straight games, if you figure that out, that's 79% of the way there. That's really not very close. Is anybody ever going to get close to this?
Well, not only did you say, not only that, so he hit it 44 straight, nobody else even hit it 40.
Right.
Right, so it's not like...
It happened once.
You know, yeah. One of the things that's amazing about it, a lot of people think it would be harder to do today, or there's more specialization of pitchers and all that. I didn't find any evidence of that whatsoever. I mean, and some of it is just, if you look at the pattern of the hitting streaks, it's not like they were reeling off 50-game hitting streaks back there in 1940 or 1930. They weren't doing it then, they're not doing it now. In fact, if you look at streaks of 30 or more games, they're just as common, slightly more common now, but basically the same as they were in the years of Joe was playing. So it seems to me when you look at it, when you do the odds of it, and when you think about all the pressures that go into it, that I don't see it breaking. I see it as the unbreakable of the breakable record. By that I mean, you know, we look at, there are these records, Jack Chesbrough winning 41 games in the season, a guy doesn't even start 41 games in the season. Right? Nope, that's not going to happen. Or one of my favorite ones is Connie Mack. He lost 3,800 games. I mean, what manager would ever take, like, ever take Terry Francona, like, 10 September? I mean, so some of these things just aren't going to happen. But 56 seems like you just got to go 1-for-4. I mean, you know, Ryan Rayburn goes 1-for-4. You know, how hard is it? But in fact, it seems to me like there's really no indication that anybody's going to get close or it's going to happen. So I think no, it won't happen.
I personally agree with you. I think also an argument can be made that it's actually with the way everyone says, oh, it's more difficult now because of pitching. I think the argument's the exact opposite. I think right. it's
you know, one thing that's interesting just related to that is I thought, as I said at the beginning of doing the book, that it would be a resonant number today and people would know about it. But I was a little surprised by how many players in locker room today did know about it. I don't mean like necessarily every relief pitcher, or Japanese relief pitcher maybe didn't know about it, but certainly offensive players did. And they, you'd go in and you'd start talking about it, and then somebody would come up, you know, Clint Farmitz comes over, oh, I hit him 30 once in my career, you know. Everybody knew about it, with one notable exception, that was Gary Sheffield. And I went down to see Chef. He was playing for the Mets. Very accommodating guy, and he just hit his 500th home run. And I just kind of wanted to talk to him about records and meetings and everything. He's about to go on the field, he's like kind of pounding his hand into it. Well, when we talk for a little bit, it comes apparent to me that he doesn't know the hitting streak record. So I said to him, I said, do you know who had the hitting streak record or what it is? He goes, no. I don't know that. Somebody who followed that, they would know that. I don't follow it, so I don't know. So, didn't really argue with it. He was talking for a little while longer, and all of a sudden he goes, so, what is that in the UK? Well, I said, well, it's Joe DiMaggio, it's 56 in the game. He just goes, had a fucking long hitting streak.
That's okay. That's all.
And I think that after all that, he really has an expert opinion because I agree.
That's great. Yeah. Well, that's Gary Sheffield in many ways.
Yeah. He was great and very happy to talk. So
that's good.
Yeah.
So for whatever it's worth, we agree there that this is not going to happen again, most likely. My other question is, will there ever be another quote unquote DiMaggio? And but what I mean by that is, the other day I'm reading in the New York Times, and Tom Friedman's op-ed piece the other day is it has nothing to do with baseball or anything, but the headline is, where have you gone, Joe DiMaggio? And I don't know if there's ever been anybody else like that since then, and I don't know if there ever will be again, as far as a baseball player goes.
Well, I'm not sure. You know, I think that he was partly... Look, he certainly had... in some ways, he was a genius, although he was limited in other ways, about his own image and the way he projected himself. And he was able to control media in a way that would be much more difficult today. So he was able to present an image. And as a baseball player, just in terms of his skill set, you know, I mean, that never struck out and hit tons of home runs. He basically hit as many home runs as he struck out in his whole career. During the streak, he hit 15 home runs and struck out 5 times. It's not possible.
That's one game now.
Right, yeah. Exactly. So, in certain ways, I think he's unique, and we probably won't see it. But, of course, the way we got Joe DiMaggio is it's from probably the most famous lyric in pop music history, the Garfunkel's A Nation Heard the Lonely Eyes to You. And it's interesting because I think that Paul Simon has said that lyric kind of came to him. He doesn't know where it came from. It just sort of came to him. And I feel that maybe if it hadn't been for the hitting streak, when he was elevated and in the public mind day after day after day, and then there was a song on the radio, not just like the Super Bowl Shuffle, but a real number one song by Les Brown, Joe DiMaggio in 1941, that this real, he was a hero. And the nation did turn its eyes to him in 1941. And this stuff came to Simon in some way. I don't think he was sitting there thinking about it. But that immortalized him further. So I think that the whole package does make him unique. In terms of whether we see, you know, there are going to be stars, there are going to be special stars. But if you think about people in the game today, and you think about a guy like Jeter, of course, is the obvious one to come to mind. And as players, you think about Pujols, and it's still a different. It feels different, and you don't feel a nation sort of I don't want to overstate it, but at that time it was a special and unique situation. And I think while you've seen things happen, such as the U.S. beat Russia in the gold medal game, and everybody's behind it, and it has geopolitical resonance, or it does or it doesn't, but it feels like it does, you don't get that as much in sports. And you don't get it over sustained periods of time the way you did with DiMaggio. So there'll be other stars, but there won't be anyone quite like Joe DiMaggio.
Yeah, interesting. Well, this, for those listening on the podcast, this is Costa Kennedy live in the Pagino Baseball Clubhouse with his book 56, Joe DiMaggio and the Last Magic Number in Sports. And we're now going to turn our lonely eyes, I guess, to anyone in our crowd who'd like to ask a question.
I've got a question. You were talking about the media and Joe DiMaggio, but don't you think that the media was... Didn't they coddle the players? Didn't they just like... Like Babe Ruth, for instance. You know, he was a trunk, but they didn't talk about that. Now, if you're a trunk, it's all over page six.
Right.
I mean, so when you say, will that ever be... Of course not, because of the media really... You know, like in streaks, too. I mean, the pressures of...
Well, I don't think... I think your first point is absolutely true, that things were swept under the rug, and people just didn't think it was that important. You know, if you were out carousing... First of all, there's plenty of stuff that gets swept under the rug now, too, but if you show up drunk, you end up having to apologize to Dave Dombrowski and your teammate. In those days, you didn't have to. But I'm not sure about the pressure thing.
If you go to like a big city like New York and then Boston, and you got like 30 reporters asking you, so how does it feel? You're getting close there, buddy. You know, after a while, it's going to get into your mind.
It probably will, and it's a fair point. It's something, you know, Pete Rose, who had a streak, he loved it. He would get to the park earlier than anybody wanted him to, and he'd do every interview, right? Today, remember that nowadays, if you're a big league player, you've been on the stage for a long time, and there's been people who make a fuss about you in a big way, and for a period of time, and now when even if you're in a regular season game, your ground rule double is on the ESPN highlights, and you're doing interviews all the time. So the threshold is a little higher. In those days, there wasn't all that. So when now all of a sudden there is a buzz, and there aren't 30 people, but there are 15 reporters, mm-hmm. and they're all writing something, and the movie cameras are down there on you, you know, there's no TV. So to me, I don't know, I think the biggest, and one of the chapters in the book talks about the sort of psychological impact and how one deals with it, and really...
Donnie Moore didn't deal with it very well.
The biggest thing is the pressure that you put on yourself, and when you become aware that you have a hitting streak, it's a lot harder. It just becomes, and so it's fair to say, certainly in terms of volume and you know, people, the minute you get a hit, it would be out there, blogged and on Twitter and all that. But I'm not convinced that it would really affect a professional ball player who's used to living a life in the spotlight and used to, you make an error and it's all over and it's everywhere. And you're right that it's heightened in a hitting streak, but I'm not sure that it's, you know, and it's just up for debate. But I don't think that it would really affect so much.
I just think the pressures are just, you know, that more, it's increased more than it was back then. Well, we had the internet, we had radio, we had print.
Yeah, in those days there was no TV.
Right.
So you
didn't have.
You would turn on the radio and you'd hear the Nazi Guard 250 miles south of Moscow. And this just then, from Washington, D.C., Joe DiMaggio is in his 42nd straight game. It was a different world. There was Joe DiMaggio's streak was on the front page above the news that, you know, Nazis take Leningrad. So, it was a different thing. I mean, I don't think it's quite comparable how to measure it, but the point is right there.
10 years later, or about 15 years later, when Mickey Mantle was on the scene, so I seem to remember a lot of comparisons you know, as also a great star, how did they line up?
Well, I didn't spend a lot of time on that part of your life, but first of all, Joe wasn't great to Mickey Mantle when he came in. But Mickey was, of course, you know, he had more blowing power, probably more speed. He probably wasn't quite the fielder that Joe was. You know, when they had, in 1969, they had a vote for Major Baseball put together something, greatest living player in every position. So it's guys like Pie Trainer at third base. They call up Willie Mays to be the greatest living right fielder. It's kind of strange to everybody, because Mays has played maybe two games in right field in all life. But everybody realized, oh, that's because Joe DiMaggio is going to be the greatest living right fielder. And then he gets named greatest living center fielder and greatest living ball player. And this is a time when Mays is around, certainly. Ted Williams, who, you know, all his incredible statistics and achievements in there. Mickey Mantle's career is over with all those home runs and all those achievements. Stan Musial. There's a lot of guys you can make the comparison with. But nobody complained. Not publicly, not in the years since, not in their books. Nobody complained about it. It seemed like Joe was the guy, if you were picking up a team on the playground, you wanted Joe. He was going to make the catch or take the extra base or do the thing that made you win the game. And ball player after ball player said that, in addition to his raw ability. So, you know, I guess, partly because I did the book, but I looked at it, I would probably pick Joe as my center fielder over Mickey. But they're, you know, they're two of the five greatest center fielders of all time. So.
What was his other hitting streak with the San Francisco Seals?
Yeah, when he was a kid in the Pacific Coast League, which was a very good league then. There was no Major League Baseball, of course, in California. Pacific Coast League was better than AAA, but not the Major League. And he hit him 61 straight. 61.
Wow.
Yeah, so there was something about DiMaggio also. Of course he got lucky at times in the streak. Of course he did. In any streak, he would. And also the day after his streak ended, he then hit a 16 streak. But there are certain things about his tendency with the ball player, both in his, you know, his result as a hitter and in his approach to the game, that suggest that it wasn't totally true, that he was a good, very good candidate.
I have a statistical question. So with thousands of games and thousands of people hitting, you know, something that's very hard and there is lots of random error in it, you would think that over 100 years or so, just by chance, even if everybody hit it 250, you'd every once in a while get a long streak. And I'm just wondering, how many streaks would you expect, say, in the past in the modern era, just by chance alone?
That's a really good question. I have a chapter in there devoted to it. And you're right, like it would be very unusual to have a season go by and nobody hit it 20 straight, or 20, 25 straight. It just gets, it's too complicated and to really get into the math of it. I don't know exactly what the odds are to have, what we mean by a long streak. But for a given hitter, for somebody like DiMaggio, you'd expect that he would have like a 12 or 14 game hitting streak during the year. It would be statistically improbable if he never had that, and he was going to hit 370 or whatever he had. So, but when you get, basically, you know, you to get a hit in one game for DiMaggio, there's an 81% chance of getting a hit in the game with his bat record. So to get in two straight, it's 0.81 times 0.81, right? And so then you go on. And it becomes infinitesimal. It's like there's no way to that.
If I may just follow
up. Absolutely.
Obviously, it's extremely unlikely for somebody to hit, especially for a given person to hit 56 straight games.
Right.
So let's acknowledge that. But let's also acknowledge that there are thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of opportunities. And actually, I think this could speak to sort of the pressure issue. My intuition is that you would actually expect, by chance, some people, at least a hand. I mean, I don't know. You could do the math. You could find out.
And
just treat people as dice at
right.
Vegas. and pick your you know the historical average batting average or whatever. Make it low, make it 200 or whatever. And my guess is that you would expect some streaks to be that long. Very, very rare because it's so incredibly hard. But to me, that makes the achievement greater because you would actually expect people to be able to do this by chance, and yet they haven't because of pressure.
It's a good point, and I ultimately what I came down on, and again, without getting too deep into it, first of all, there's been a lot of really interesting work done, and they do Bernoulli trials, which are basically measuring the point foot, and they're trying to figure out that. One of the things that's really interesting about it is that people who really know what they're doing come up with very different answers, right? So that's one indication. I end up saying it's just an enigma. It's sort of like saying, you know, well, there's got to be life on another planet. Look at all the stars up there and all the things. There's got to be, right? But there's really no way to know. And I think that the situation of a hitting streak becomes so... It's almost artificial, right? Because there is the pressure... And where, if you think it's greater now, yes, or then, whatever, clearly there's pressure. So it affects your performance as a hitter. But also the opposing pitcher is affected. They might treat you differently. The opposing manager might pitch you differently. Your teammates might do different things. It becomes a very, very difficult... People like to measure sports because it's kind of a control system, right? You know it's going to be... You know it's 60 feet, 6 inches from home to play. You know a basketball, regulation basketball game that's 48 minutes. You can count on things in this environment that you can't necessarily count on in everyday life. But I think that some of those things get blurred at the edges when you're in the street. They'll become difficult to predict. But as I say, there's a chapter in the book about it, and it's really, I found it fascinating, and it spoke to a lot of really interesting people about the odds issue.
Before we get to the next question, just another endorsement I want to give to the book is exactly what you said. There is this one chapter that deals specifically with this, which was fascinating. But I love the fact that you kind of put it all into one chapter as opposed to getting bogged down with statistics, which this easily could have been for 300 pages.
Yeah, I put it sort of at the end, sort of there, and a lot of people responded really well, wanted to read it. Some people said, what did I need that for? You know, I read everything because it's... You know, you have to really spend some time thinking about it. But I felt like it had to be addressed because it's such a... People spent time and I found it interesting.
Does the 56 game hitting streak mean that Joe DiMaggio possessed the greatest hitting skills of any player in baseball history?
I don't know exactly how to measure that because it's still it's relatively... It's not a fluke such as, you know, getting 7 hits in a game like 9-10. Just on that point, if you look at guys who've had great streaks, once you get up into the 40s, high 30s, 40s, these are ball players. They're DiMaggio, Willie Keeler, Ty Cobb, George Sisler, Pete Rose. They're all time great. They're Hall of Famers. So you have to be very good to have it. It's not like, you know, Mark Whitman hit 4 home runs in the game. It's not that. But at the same time, there is, of course, an element of chance. And there is, of course, you know, Ted Williams, who was probably the greatest hitter in real life, he would certainly like us to say that. So that's all I'm saying. He walked so much, some people say, to his detriment, but some people say that's the point, the update, that he wasn't going to be a candidate for hitting streak. Because he robbed himself of so many opportunities to get ahead than you all. So his long thing is 23. You can clearly make the argument that he was a more effective hitter, a more skilled hitter.
Just coming back to the hitting streak, I think now it's harder because you have relief pitchers coming in like the 6th inning. And so now you have seeing another style of pitching, where before the pitcher pitched like 8 innings, right? So you got to see him 4 times for the whole game. So you knew what he was doing.
Intuitively, a lot of people say that, intuitively. There's just no evidence whatsoever to suggest that it's more difficult. They just isn't. I mean, there's no... A lot of relievers you've seen aren't such great pitchers.
But you saw the same pitcher, though, right?
You're absolutely right. And you see DiMaggio, I think, saw 55 pitchers over the course of his streak, and Ryan Zimmerman had a 30-game streak in 2009, saw 62 in 30 games. You not only are you seeing more pitchers in the game, but there's more teams, right? So you only face 17, you're going to see them again, the same starters are going to come up. So I agree, it seems like it. But batting averages, let's leave out the last year and a half, or 2 years, I guess, with the pitching has kind of come back into dominance. But if you look in the last 8-9 years, it's not as if batting averages were higher then than they are now. It's just, statistically, it's just as easy to get a hit today as it was then. So while it does seem, oh my God, here's a guy throwing the sidearm, or here's a guy coming over the top at 96 miles an hour, it'd be harder. For some reason, it doesn't appear the results don't bear out.
But it's interesting. Correct that skill. Good question. How did Joe feel about it? Like, even Richard Williams, it's hard to mark the question. And then you're talking trash. You could say, I get 400. Joe recognized that 56 was kind of a fluky thing. Not to take it away from him, or did he think, hey, this is something I did that don't know?
No, I think he definitely thought the latter. I think he was really aware during the streak that he was leaving the legacy of what he was doing. And he didn't even talk about it or alluded to it. You know, this was his 747 average. He wanted it. He very much wanted it. He wanted to go continue it. Although the night it ended, it was a 2 minutes, he kind of said, I'm glad it's over. And he said, I feel like I lost my best time. But I think that he was, you know, and again, it's not like he, of course there's luck, as we keep saying, but he earned it in this time, because it's not as if he's just some guy who had 50 game days. He was a great hitter, and he wanted, he didn't seem to be, he was very concerned with his own image, and bristled that he really got short trip, but he wasn't as directly, certainly not in 1941, he wasn't as directly concerned with Williams as Williams could be with DiMaggio. You know, in some ways, Williams was much more easygoing and talk about other things. But he was, when it came down to like competition against other guys, he was very much like, "What is it? I hit 406. You didn't hit 406." You know? but no, I think he was very proud.
I have one silly question. Hines. He would have hit 57. Was there a contract waiting for him?
Yeah,
I mean, is that true?
That's a long told story. That Hines catch-up wanted him to be in 57 straight, which gave him a contract. I don't think it's true. And for a couple of reasons. Some people have said it is, but there's no real proof of it. And some, Joe told people both things. But it also doesn't really make sense, like, maybe not to stop at 57.
I just
thought that. But no, it's out there. There's a bat boy in Cleveland. Like years later, said, "Yeah, and he dropped the contract in the garbage can, and I had it." And this made the news a little bit. Of course, he never could produce it; he just said that he had it. So I don't think it's true.
Okay.
Any other questions from our gallery? No. All right. Well, to those who are listening on the podcast, you can certainly pick up this great book. I think Kostya has. You've learned tonight why this is such a great book, and it's just beautifully written. It's a beautiful, you tell a beautiful story. And again, it's 56, Joe DiMaggio and the last magic number in sports. And one of the things we do in the clubhouse, this was my decision when we started this book series, I never wanted an author to come here, stand up, open the book, read page 17, and sit down. Frankly, even a book as great as this, I find that extremely boring. I think this is much more interesting. But the only thing I would like to do, which this is a first, I'd like to end the podcast with the last sentence of your book. Since you ended the book that way, we're going to end our podcast that way. And then for all those here, Kostya's going to be selling his books tonight. Please feel free to pick one up, have a free beer, got soda, Cracker Jacks. Those listening on the podcast, you can get this book anywhere, and please do so. And Kostya ends the book, through the end of the 2010 season, 17,290 players were known to have appeared in the major leagues. Only one of them had ever hit in 56 straight games. Thank you, Costa.
Thank you, Jerry.